So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming. And I'm so glad we didn't get snow this afternoon. But who knows, maybe more snow is coming. So this evening, I am sort of experimenting with bringing together a number of stories and reflections on the theme of elephants. Now, I thought I would just begin by asking if any of you have ever met an elephant. Yes. Wonderful. And did you conceive a great affection for elephants from that encounter? Yes. So, the proceeds tonight from this evening of storytelling will be going to the World Wildlife Fund in support of their programs. Welcome. So the World Wildlife Fund, I've been doing a bit of research, and they are engaged in so many different activities to support the continued survival of elephants, both in Africa and in Asia. And one of the things they're doing is teaching locals how to have a kind of flying elephant squad, and there's a bit of information at the back about that. Teaching locals how to ride an elephant and frighten off the wild elephants so they'll go back into the forests where they won't be in danger. And the main, there are two main obstacles for their continued survival, and one of them is, of course, the poaching of ivory. And it's so interesting that this isn't a new issue, but one that goes back centuries. And then the other is, of course, human encroachment on elephant range and habitat. So as we, you know, it was wonderful to hear the owl. Thank you for alerting me to that sound. As you know, the fact that we have wildlife in Victoria, I think is really important, and it reminds us of wilderness and how wilderness nourishes us on a profound level, whether or not we ever go really into the wild. You know, the existence of elephants nourishes us, whether or not we ever get to meet one. And giraffes and all the wild and magnificent creatures of the world. So these teachings of the Buddha, you know, they really represent his skill as a master of metaphor. And he really saw how people going about their daily lives, they would be aware of creatures, and how that, welcome, hi, and how people's encounter with animals on a very ongoing basis could actually be a means of awakening them to some aspect of the Buddhist teachings. And so, for example, in the Dhammapada, a collection of wisdom sayings of the Buddha, there's a whole chapter devoted to elephants and the ways in which elephants teach us, like a tamed elephant teaches us about restraint, about self-discipline, about endurance. So, and then another verse, here's a verse from the Dhammapada. Delight in heedfulness. So this word apamada is really encouraging us to be attentive, but more than just mindful, it's really alert to our habits of mind, alert to our tendencies to fall into different patterns of thinking, rumination, stories, ways in which we see ourselves and see the world around us. So delight in heedfulness, to really take tremendous joy and being aware and alert to the ways in which we view experience and we view the world. Welcome. So then, in the next line, keep watch over your mind. Lift yourself up from the difficult road like a tusker sunk in the swamp. So people would have seen an elephant, you know, rising up from the mud, rising up from the swamp, and using the energy of his limbs to stand up and stand straight and be tall and be strong. And so inviting people to really think about, you too can use your energy, your skill, your wisdom to lift yourself up from those states in which you have become mired and stuck. So, good evening. There are a couple of seats, Moira, Amy, right up here. So in Pali, the words are apamada ratta hota sachitam anurakata duga udaratanam pankesanova kunjaro. Again, apamada ratta hota sachitam anurakata duga udaratanam pankesanova kunjaro. So lift yourself up from the difficult road like a tusker sunk in the swamp. So this difficult road, I mean, it's actually just the human journey, the daily encounter with those mind states that become so habitual, like grasping and aversion. So so I invite you to see this really as an opportunity for bringing attentiveness, mindfulness to the experience of listening, but also to be aware of how the stories are calling to your own experience, how you, as you listen, how you find yourself responding to the images in the stories. Because, as we know, stories are always calling to other stories. And some stories we resonate with, and they speak to us because of aspects of our own experience. So please get comfortable. And just a couple of words about this instrument. This is a melodic, tuned metal drum made in... guess what country? Anybody want to guess?
Trinidad?
India. Okay, I'll give you three clues. Think mountains, think chocolate, think cheese. Switzerland. So, the drum was invented about the year 2000. And I was very fortunate to get one because my friend David Cates was bringing them back from Bern, from Switzerland. It's called a Hang, H-A-N-G. And the original makers are no longer making them. Very fortunate to have one of the original instruments. And they are now being made by other people around the world. A variation on, but very similar. And so I'll just play you the scale. And then the other side, you can play like a clay drum. So anyway, my guitar teacher has been assisting me in learning how to compose on the Hang. So. Thank you. Late in the evening, the elephant began to scratch one shoulder against the post in the corner of his stall. He scratched and he scratched some more, and then he crouched a little to get a better angle. Ah, that was better. And then he settled down for the night. His mahout, his keeper, usually gave him a good scratch with a nice pointed stick, but on this particular evening, his mahout had forgotten. As Mahinamuka settled down in the straw, he could hear music and drums away in the distance. Somebody was having a celebration without him. It had been another quiet day, another day like all the other days, a stroll around the garden in the company of his mahout, a stop by the lily pond, a chance to gaze at his reflection, and then a brief encounter with the king, who stroked his trunk and said what he always said, "Mahinamuka, Mahinamuka, aren't you sweet?" The king doted on the elephant. In fact, it was the king who had decided to call him Mahinamuka, which means sweetness or damsel face. From a young age, everyone had noticed how placid the elephant was, how good-natured, how sweet, how innocent. He sauntered or strolled after the other elephants, but he never roughhoused like they did. He didn't even want to roll in the mud, spray himself like all the others. No, Mahinamuka was purity incarnate. And the king noticed how sweet he was, and he said, "This elephant, we must somehow safeguard his innocence. We must prevent him from ever being corrupted by the other elephants." And so Mahinamuka lived alone. No company, no one to play with, no one to rub shoulders with, no one to walk side by side with, no one to be his friend. The years went by and he grew up, and the only one who ever talked to him was his mahout, who told him about his life and his children. But his children weren't even allowed to visit for fear that they might corrupt him. Now one evening, a gang of thieves entered the king's garden. They looked about for a suitable place to plan their next robbery. There was a good overhang by the elephant stables, and that's where they made their way and crouched there in the soft earth. And the robber chief took a stick and began to draw in the earth. "You see," he said, "and make a mark. If you go along here, you'll come to the treasurer's back door. Then over the wall and up the steps and into the house. Don't make a sound. Step lightly. Tread softly. You will find small chests that will be easy to carry away." "But what if someone should wake?" asked one of the other thieves. "Then you know what to do." And he stabbed his stick right into the ground. "You knew what to do, so they never wake again." Well, in his stall, Mahinamuka, the soul of innocence, heard these strange plans, the strange tone of voice, a tone of voice he'd never heard before. And he shuddered. He didn't like it. He didn't like it at all, and he hoped they would go away. Well, they did go away, but they came back the next night. They came back one night, two nights. They came back every night for a week, planning and carefully reviewing all the details of their big robbery. And every night, again, the robber chief, he would repeat, "If you have a knife, you might just have to use it. Remember, We are not men who care about the feelings or the property or the lives of others. Well, every night Mihilamukha heard these words, and every night he shuddered a little less. Until finally, one morning, he said to himself, "This must be some kind of instruction for me. This must be the way I'm supposed to be." And when his mahout, his dear friend the mahout, came into the stall and began to move about, pouring fresh water in his drinking trough, bringing fresh hay, Mihilamukha pinned him up against the wall. "Mihilamukha," said the mahout. Mihilamukha pinned him and pinned him until finally the poor man fell to the ground. Then Mihilamukha burst out of the stall and went rampaging through the king's gardens. He trampled flowers. He pulled up shrubs and small trees. He made a great bellowing and trumpeting noise. All the stable hands, all the pages and the king's courtiers came running, and they saw Mihilamukha, damsel face, gone berserk in the gardens. At last, the elephant came to a standstill by the lily pond and looked down and saw his own face, which showed only confusion and fear, anger. He didn't recognize himself. And he looked around and saw the garden in disarray. What a disaster! His heart was filled with regret. Well, another keeper, another one of the king's keepers, brought him back to his stall, and his mahout was taken away and tended to by the king's doctors. But the king was puzzled. What had happened? He summoned his advisor. His chief advisor went and spoke to everyone and anyone who might have been in contact with the elephant in the previous days. And at last, one of the stable hands said he had heard voices outside the stables. Well, the chief advisor, examining the earth right under the eaves, saw the markings made by the robber chief. He understood very well who had been plotting and planning there. He said to the king, "Your Majesty, Mihilamukha needs good company, just like all of us. Mihilamukha needs someone to play with, to walk with, to tell stories to. He needs wise men and kind men. He needs children, wise women, all kinds of people. He needs to be educated into the goodness of his heart through conversation, through dialogue, through friendship." And so it was after that. People came and sat under one of the neem trees in the garden, and Mihilamukha stood placidly by, listening. Children came, climbed up on his back, played with him, and he lost his baby innocence, but he grew wiser and kinder thanks to the company he kept. Mihilamukha Jataka. So that story is one of the Jataka tales, and the Jataka tales are really one of the oldest story collections of the world, and they are presented within the Buddhist tradition as the Buddha's recollection of his previous lives. And what's really interesting about the Jataka tales is they have a very specific structure. So some monks might have been discussing or arguing or commenting on a situation, and then the Buddha would arrive and say, "Oh, what are you talking about this evening?" And they would say, "Oh, we're talking about those two monks who go everywhere together." And he would say, "Oh, well, that reminds me of a story." And then he would launch into one of these Jataka tales, and at the end, it's sort of like the credits at the end of a movie, he would identify who played which role according to the members of his community. He would say, "Well, I was the king," or "I was the advisor," or "I was the elephant, and my worthy attendant was, you know, this role or that role." So it's so interesting how the stories are structured. And then there would be a very final note in the passage which would say, on the conclusion of this story, everyone present attained to the first stage of awakening. So how are you feeling? But we must be careful about boasting about our attainments. So the next story I'm going to tell you is the very first of the stories that I translated. And I was living in Barre, Massachusetts. I was working as a cook at Insight Meditation Society in Barre. And I had the opportunity to study Pali, which is the language in which the early Buddhist teachings are handed down in. And I was so thrilled to begin to learn the grammar. But what was really challenging is that the Pali English Dictionary is arranged according to where the sounds are formed in the mouth. So I, O, U, and then ka. So it was very difficult for a while to figure out how to use the dictionary. And sometimes it would take me an hour to translate one sentence. So the first story I translated is this one that I'm going to tell you now, Silvanaga Jataka. And I have been telling, you know, I've told this story a few times over the years. And this evening I am experimenting with three different endings. So I'm going to tell the story, and then I'm going to give you each of the possible endings, and for you to reflect and really consider which ending speaks to you in this time in your life and in your, you know, appreciation or the way the story resonates with you. Stories were told about the silver elephant, Silvanaga. Some of the young elephants even claimed they had seen him, a silvery blur moving beyond the trees, climbing the slope of a mountain. They said, "You know, at birth, he was white all over. He shone in the moonlight like a mass of silver coins." Apparently, according to legend, at one time, this elephant, this magnificent elephant, had been the leader of their herd. He had roamed with them across the grassy slopes, down into the deep river valleys and through the forests of pine and oak, maple, and rhododendron in the foothills of the Himalayas. Well, when quarreling began among the young elephants, he summoned them, he instructed them, he admonished them, he rebuked them, he encouraged them. But they just wouldn't listen. They kept on with their bickering and their quarreling. And so he left the herd and he went to live alone, deep in the forest, where it was quiet in the morning, except for the twittering of the birds, where it was even quieter at noon, except for the buzz of insects and the whir of little wings, and even quieter still in the evening when everything settled down for the night. He enjoyed his quiet. He enjoyed his solitude. He never longed for company or visitors. He was content to live his life. But one day, a visitor came. The forester had climbed up from the village at daybreak and entered the cool shade of the forest when the sun was high overhead. He was pleased to see so many sturdy, straight trees, not too big and nice and round. It would be easy to cut them down and drag them out with his crew of men. He kept wandering deeper and deeper into the forest, wondering how long it went on for. He could see a fortune flowing his way. He looked back occasionally. He didn't want to get lost. There were tigers in these forests, they said. But as the shadows lengthened, he did get lost. In his panic, he began to run. But he was running deeper into the forest rather than from the direction where he had entered. And he couldn't help himself. He let out a whirling sound, and then another one. In his fear that he might attract the attention of wild beasts, he did attract the attention of one. The elephant, standing in the clearing where he lived, with his great ears, listening to the sounds of the forest, heard a human voice, a man wailing and lamenting, a man who seemed stricken with fear, even terror. Well, compassion for this bewildered human sprang up in his heart, and he went lumbering slowly through the trees in the direction of the man's wailing. By now the forester was huddled under a tree, and when he felt the earth shaking, he looked up and saw an elephant coming his way. He was sure it was a rogue elephant who was going to dash him to the ground. He sprang up from his seat, began running and wailing some more, and looking back to see how close the elephant was, he saw that the great beast had actually come to a standstill. Well, how strange. And the elephant, seeing that the forester was now standing in one place, again advanced and tried to step as softly as he could so as not to alarm him. But the man, seeing the elephant approach, once more ran. And again the king of the elephants stopped and stood in one place. And then the forester said to himself, "Is it possible? This elephant doesn't wish to harm me, but wishes to help me." He summoned all his courage, which wasn't very much, and stood in one place and closed his eyes and waited to see what would happen. Well, the elephant came forward and stood before the man who was trembling there.
"Bo Puriso, Bo Puriso, human man. Why do you wander about lamenting in this way?"
The forester looked up at the great elephant, his gleaming tusks and his great elephant ears.
"Sorry, my lord. I fear to perish. I fear to perish."
puriso, you shall not perish. Follow me.
And so the elephant turned about and returned to his glade. And the man, what choice did he have? The forester followed him back to the elephant's glade, where the elephant offered him wild fruit and showed him a place in the stream that ran through the glade where he might drink. The forester drank and nibbled at some fruit and then sank into an exhausted sleep. And in the morning, as the sun was coming up, he awoke. And there was that elephant again. At first he was frightened, but then he remembered that the elephant had actually saved him. He stood up and bowed to the elephant, who said,
"Bo puriso,
we shall go now. I shall take you to the road which leads to where men dwell. But, human man, I ask you, tell no one of the road that leads to where I dwell."
I promise,
Sami, I promise. And then the elephant knelt on the ground, invited the man to take his seat upon his back, which the forester did, climbing on, getting his balance. And then the elephant stood up, and they made their way. But as they went, that forester made note of rock and tree and shrub and stone and twist and turn, that he might find his way back again, should he need to. Well, they came at last to the edge of the forest, and the elephant knelt once more on the ground, and the forester dismounted. And once more, as he stood, the elephant admonished the forester, "Remember your promise, human man. Tell no one of the road that leads to where I dwell."
I promise,
said the forester. And they went their separate ways, the elephant back into the coolness of the woods, and the forester quickly at a run down the hill along the path right to the village, and in the village right to the market, and in the market right to the ivory workers' bazaar. He watched the ivory workers as they crafted fine ornaments, tools, combs, pendants. And finally he approached, and he said,
I wonder what you might give for the tusks of a living elephant, Jivadanto. The tusks of a living elephant? Are you mad? It is impossible to remove the tusks of an elephant without killing him. But if it were so, the tusks of a living elephant would be worth much more than the tusks of a dead one.
Well then, said the forester, I shall bring you some tusks of a living elephant, Jivadanto. It took him a few days to assemble provisions for the journey. He borrowed a saw. He borrowed a rope, and he set off. Arriving at the edge of the glade, just as Silvanaga, the elephant king, was finishing his morning bath, he had let his curling trunk fill with water from the mountain stream, and let fall a stream over his head and neck and shoulders, till sparkling drops of water fell from his elephant ears. Well, the forester, even though his heart was filled with greed, he stood and watched in amazement, astonished by the beauty of this great animal.
"Bo puriso,
You have returned. Why is that? Said the elephant.
Sami, my lord, I came to ask you for your tusks, but...
Sami, I have no need of your tusks. I have enough. I have enough.
Wait, Forester, I can give you my tusks. Come, if you have brought a saw, come, you may take my tusks.
The forester was astonished. The elephant knelt on the ground, and then the forester, well, he propped one grimy foot against the elephant's jaw, and he sawed and sawed and sawed away until one tusk fell to the ground. And then he went around the elephant's trunk, and on the other side he sawed and sawed until the second tusk fell into the ground. And then the elephant lifted both tusks in his trunk, and he said,
May my gift to you of these two tusks bring me insight and wisdom.
The forester bowed. He bundled the tusks in a rope, and off he went through the forest and back to the village, where he sold those tusks for a good price. He spent the money, and then he thought, you know, I didn't saw those tusks very well. I left stumps, and those stumps, why, each of those stumps is still quite a bit of ivory. And so he returned. The elephant saw him standing at the edge of the glade.
Boo, pretty so, you have come back a second time.
What is it that you want?
Sami, my lord, you have been so generous. You gave me your tusks, but I ask you now, could you give me the stumps of your tusks?
Well,
Boo pretty so. You may have the stumps of my tusks.
Once more, the elephant knelt on the ground. And this time, the forester paid careful attention to get every bit of that ivory, cutting so close to the skin of the elephant's face that he grazed it with the blade of the saw. Both of those stumps, those ivory stumps, fell to the ground. These he bundled up and took away with him. Now, a man who receives a gift may get in the habit of receiving gifts, may get in the habit of seeking gifts from the same source. This greedy forester, this man, this human man, he thought to himself, you know, an ivory tusk is just like a tooth, and a tooth grows in the jaw, in the face, in the mouth, and there are roots that hold it in place. Surely those roots are made of ivory as well. A third time, he returned to the elephant's glade. A third time, Silavanaga, the elephant king, saw him standing there.
Boo Puriso,
Boo Puriso, you have come back yet a third time. What is it that you want? Well, this time, this time the forester, seeing the elephant there without his tusks, seeing his nobility and his strength and his beauty, this time he said, I would have asked you for the roots of your tusks, but I cannot. I truly have enough. I bow to you, great king. And then he bowed and he went away, and truly he never did return. But did it really happen like that? The forester returned to the glade a third time. This is the second ending. Again, the king of the elephants, Silvanaga, said, Bo Puriso, why have you come? I have given you my tusks. I have given you the stumps of my tusks. What is it that you wish for?
Sami, my lord, I ask you, give me the roots of your tusks.
The elephant looked at him, and great compassion for the man and for his greed arose in him, and he said,
Bo Puriso,
you have taken enough. This is not wisdom for me to give you any more. Go now and learn the meaning of enough. Ashamed, embarrassed, humiliated, the forester left the glade and returned to the village. And whether he learnt the meaning of enough or not, we do not know. The third ending. Well, the elephant again was taking his morning bath, and the droplets of water were sparkling from his elephant ears when he sensed a presence in the glade.
Bo Puriso, I see you have returned. Why have you come?
Sami, my lord, I am a poor, wretched man. I have sold your tusks. I have sold the stumps of your tusks. But truly, it is not easy for a man to live these days. I beg of you, give me the roots of your tusks.
Very well, said the Bodhisatta Silvanaga, and he knelt upon the ground, and the greedy forester climbed up on his brow and used his saw to cut away the flesh surrounding the elephant's ivory roots, and these he extracted and bowed, more of a cringing gesture, and made his way out of the glade. But as he did so, the earth, which is inconceivable in its vast extent, which supports the weight of the great mountains of the world, the earth burst asunder in revulsion at the greed of this human man, and flames shot up from nethermost hell, enshrouded the man in a circle of fire, and bore him away. And the tree fairy, who lives in those parts, repeated this verse. The greedy man, even were he offered the entire world, still would ask for more. Silvanaga Jataka.
Thank you.
So I have another story for you. So this is one of the Buddhist legends. Those were both Jataka tales. And this story is one of the Buddhist legends. So these are stories of miraculous events. Usually there's a miracle in the story. Miraculous events that took place during the Buddha's lifetime. Now, I've been telling this story again for a number of years, but I was thinking about how to tell it a little bit differently. And I was thinking about how often we ourselves draw on our own experience to instruct others. You know, it's really good to be prepared. So, you know, we might say to an adolescent or someone we know, giving them some advice about an event, or, you know, even sharing ideas about how to sleep well, or, you know, how we share stories and we share experiences. So this story features the Buddha's chief attendant, Ananda. But the story takes place after the Buddha's death. So, all right, here we go. Was doing his walking meditation outside his dwelling place, back and forth, feeling his feet fall on the swept earth in the shade of the trees of Bamboo Grove, one of the monasteries that had been given to the Buddha during his lifetime outside the city of Rajgir, Rajagaha. Back and forth he walked, waiting for his pupils to arrive, the young monks, the novices, whom he was teaching about metta, loving kindness. At length, the monks arrived. He could see them scurrying through the trees, adjusting their robes, trying to make themselves look respectable. They came, they bowed. It was such an honor to receive teachings from Ananda, who had been the Buddha's chief attendant for 25 years. 25 years! They took their seat before him, and he said, "Now, have any of you committed any of the verses by heart? Have you learned them? It would be good, it would be wise, it would be useful." One skinny young monk stood up. "Yes, Bhante, I have. I'm prepared to recite. Karaniya mata kusalena
Yan tan san tang padang.
He spoke the verse of the Metta Sutta. This is what ought to be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let him be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. Let him not do the slightest thing which the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at peace.
Ananda nodded.
Very good, very good. One of the other monks, a young fellow, he said, Bhante, I have heard, and I don't believe it, but maybe you can explain, I have heard that if you practice loving kindness, you won't be afraid anymore.
Well, this young monk, he was having trouble sleeping. He was having nightmares. He was away from home for the first time, and he was experiencing a lot of fear and homesickness.
Is it true, Bhante, that if you practice loving kindness, you won't be afraid?
It is true. It is true, Rahula. And in fact, it also helps with sleeping. They say that if you practice metta, you will be loved by children and animals. You will wake easily. You will go to sleep easily. You will be protected from fire and poison. You must practice this every day. You must practice for those you know and care for, and for those you do not even know. And to all the creatures of the world, you must extend loving kindness. It is a powerful force.
Ananda, the venerable elder, he looked at the faces of the young monks. They were young indeed. He could see that they were skeptical.
Perhaps you don't believe me.
I shall tell you a story, and perhaps then you shall believe me. And this is not a story of some other lifetime. This is a story of this lifetime.
Once there was a great elephant. Perhaps you have heard tell of him.
His name was Nalagiri. From the elephant wood, he was brought when he was young to be a tusker in the king's army. King Bimbisara had no elephant to equal Nalagiri. With his massive shoulders, his gleaming tusks, his four great feet, and his ferocious strength, he was unstoppable, trampling and crushing everything that lay in his path. All the king's enemies trembled at the sight of Nalagiri. And on rare occasions, when he was paraded through the streets of the city, decked out in glittering brocade, the people trembled too. They hung well back from the roadside, or they watched from the safety of rooftops, whispering, Mahahati, Nalagiri, the elephant, the elephant. Once, Nalagiri was startled by a dog barking in an alleyway. He began to stampede through the streets. Well, the people, seeing the great elephant on the loose, they ran before him in terror for their lives. Well, Nalagiri, he only ran to ease his panic, pounding the earth with his great feet, raising a cloud of dust. But when he saw the people running, he knew well that he inspired fear. He lifted up his trunk and trumpeted and swung his tusks from side to side. Well, what happened is that his keepers, after he'd been calmed and brought back, his keepers took to giving him palm wine every day. 8 measures of palm wine. They poured it into his drinking trough, and they bound his legs. So he spent his hours in a bewildered haze, like a smoldering fire that only wants some fuel to set it ablaze. Now, at the time that Nalagiri lived, the Blessed One, our teacher, he often came to Bamboo Grove, where we find ourselves tonight. And he received gifts and offerings from all his many disciples. By that time in his life, the Blessed One, the Buddha, had attained great renown, and many, many monasteries and pleasant groves had been offered to him. And many were his disciples, such as the king, Bimbisara, who often came to receive teachings. Now, you may have also heard of the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, unfortunately also a cousin of mine. Devadatta, when he was a young monk, and let this be a lesson to you, young men, as soon as he entered the order, because of perhaps previous lifetimes of practice, he easily attained certain psychic powers. Yes, he could read the minds of others. Why, he could sometimes walk on water if he concentrated enough. Very occasionally, he could fly through the air. He could hear at great distances and see at great distances as well. He even claimed that he could transform his body and take on the form of an animal, though I never saw it, and I don't believe he could. Because of his attainment, and he boasted of it, I have to say, and let that also be a lesson to you, you must never boast of your attainments. Because he had attained these psychic powers to some degree, he believed himself to equal the Buddha. And so he asked the Buddha to give over the care and keeping and the leadership of the community of monks. He came to the Buddha and he asked once, he asked twice, and each time the Buddha just shook his head. But when he asked a third time, the Buddha spoke to him. On no uncertain terms, he said, "Devadatta, I am not intending to ever give over the community of monks, not even to my worthy disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana. When I die, the Dhamma shall be your gift from me. You will have no need of a leader." Anyway, Devadatta, I would never give over the community of monks to one such as you. Well, Devadatta went away then, humiliated. He set himself to bring about the destruction of the Buddha, of the Blessed One. And do you know what he did? He went right to the elephant stables. He enlisted the help of King Bimbisara's son, Ajatasattu, and gained admittance. He spoke to Nalagiri's keepers. He showed them, by torchlight, a bag of glinting golden coins. He promised them wealth and honor and renown. And all they had to do was pour 16 measures of palm wine into Nalagiri's drinking trough. All they had to do was unbind his chains, open wide the stable doors, and then, at a signal, prick him and stick him and set him loose right onto the streets of the city, right onto the path of the Blessed One and all the monks as they came into Rajagaha on alms round. Well, the news, it spread through the city. And the next morning, people had gathered on the rooftops either to see the Buddha tame the great elephant or to see the great elephant trample that recluse mendicant. That's what they called the Buddha, those who were not his disciples and followers. The streets were empty, just the occasional dog wandering here and there, all the carts abandoned, tea stalls abandoned. At a signal, those elephant keepers moved quietly about the stall where Nalagiri was beginning to drink. And 16 measures were poured into his drinking trough, and he sucked them up and poured them into his mouth, and the air in the stall was filled with the sweet odor of the palm wine. He kept on drinking and drinking, barely aware that he was being unbound
and then blinking at the sight of so much daylight. This is what I heard. And then they pricked him, and they stuck him, and they slapped him, and Nalakiri charged forth into the street and began a rampage through the streets of Rajagaha. The first thing he saw was a garland seller cart. He twisted his trunk around it, upended it, and smashed it to the ground, trampling the flowers. And then he went careening from one side of the street to the other, smashing into house fronts, knocking over stalls, breaking masonry and wood. And the people began to call out, "Hattiya Ganatti, Hattiya Ganatti! The elephant is coming, the elephant is coming!" Well, I was with the Buddha that day. We heard the calling, we heard the crying, we heard the smashing and splintering. And all of us, all the monks gathered in front of the Buddha, and we said, "Bhante, Padante, please, we beg of you, stand back, stand aside. Let us return to Velavana. Let us receive offerings from Bimbisara. We do not need to go an alms round. Nalagiri will trample you." The Buddha said, "Do not be afraid. A Buddha cannot be killed in such a way." Well, the monks stood aside, but I could not bear the thought of my teacher, my beloved teacher, being trampled by the elephant. I stood before the Buddha. I was prepared to die. I was prepared to die for him. But the Buddha said, "Stand aside, Ananda." I obeyed him. I stepped to the side of the road, but I couldn't help myself. A second time, I came, I stood before him, 10 yards in front, so the elephant would trample me. But again, the Buddha said, "Stand aside, Ananda." Again, I went and stood by the road, but I couldn't help myself. Again, I stood before the Buddha, now 20 yards before him, and then, by his power, the Buddha lifted me in the air and set me down behind all the monks so that I would not be able to make my way between them and come before him and between him and the elephant. And now the elephant was charging up the road, and I watched as I could. The elephant came charging forward, and the Buddha seemed to grow more radiant and more still. He was sending his loving-kindness, wave of wave of it, towards the charging elephant. Now you must know, young monks, that metta is imbued with wisdom. Metta understands the suffering of others, understands their longing for safety and happiness. So as the Buddha was sending forth his loving kindness, the oceanic force of his unconditional love, the whole of Nalagiri's life unfolded before his eyes. He saw the elephant's capture as a young elephant in the elephant's woods. He saw how he was brought to the city and trained to be a tusker and a slayer of men. He saw the elephant's great loneliness, his fear and confusion. And still he sent forth wave upon wave, and the elephant now slowed to a walk. We all took a breath in amazement to see the charging beast control his steps. And the elephant came forward, and it was remarkable to see him bow his head and reach forward his long curling trunk, and with the very end of it he formed a cup and scooped up a handful of dust, and then he sprinkled the dust on the feet, the bare feet of the Buddha. And then the elephant knelt upon the ground, slowly bringing his massive weight to the earth. And the Buddha came forward unafraid and placed one hand on the brow, the kumbha of the elephant. And he said, Umbo Nalagiri. Umbo, my friend, you are safe now. You are safe. And the people were astonished. The people called out, Patiharam, it is a miracle, Patiharam, it is a miracle. They cast garlands and flowers, trinkets and jewels, until the massive form of the elephant was entirely covered. And then the Buddha said, still with his hand on the elephant's brow, Nalagiri, you have a new name now, and it is Dhanapalako, guardian of the treasure. And the treasure, my friend, the treasure is your own loving heart. Well, the Venerable Ananda finished his story, and the young monks sat there with their eyes open in amazement. Is it true? Is it really true? He stopped an elephant? He stopped an elephant? It is true. It is true, said the Venerable Elder. And let that be a reminder to you, each of you. Cultivate, nourish this loving kindness. It is in each of your hearts. No matter what you have suffered, no matter of what you are afraid, practice, extend goodwill to your neighbors, your fellow monks, to the snakes that wander among the trees, to the birds that alight and wake you in the morning, to the trees and the plants, and to all those whom you might consider even your enemies. Extend loving kindness so that your entire being is suffused and it radiates in all directions. And that was the lesson and the legend of Nalagiri. Stories. And if you'd like to clap, that would be fine. Actually, it's important to clap so that we come back to real time. So I had thought of just asking you to perhaps turn to someone next to you and just, if you feel like it, if you don't feel like it, just keep your, stay in your quiet space. But if you feel like just sharing with the person next to you any of those stories that spoke to you, just if one of those stories spoke to you, just for a couple of minutes. So just if you feel like turning to someone next to you and just reflecting on the story with someone. And I'll tap the drum when...
So lovely to see people speaking. So thank you for engaging with the stories and discussing them. I think that's wonderful. I'm so glad you had we're willing to do that. You had a group discussion. Oh, that's great. Does anybody want to share any reflection with all of us? Anybody want to share anything? Any thoughts? Oh yes, what's your name? Hi, Jillian.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you. I mean, it's so lovely at our age to have somebody telling stories. And I have to, it helps me to close my eyes, because then I can start to picture what you're saying instead of being distracted by the visuals in the room. And it just takes me away from, it's an escape.
Mm.
And it's a lovely escape, and the messages are really clear, and it's, yeah, you did a really good job. For me, it was that.
Thank you. Oh, yes.
Well, I just want to thank you. My name is Suha, and you are a great storyteller. to make it, you know, this beautiful, you know, it's you're always in the way, you know, you take us like the images we get, and I resonate with all the stories that you did say. The last one was like the loving hair. Unbearable, it's like God, elephant, and you're gonna, okay, that's it, you know, and you go and
Mm.
But then it's put in mind that, you know, the loving thing happens, you know, so sometimes it's better not to say anything and not to engage.
Lovely, thank you.
The alternate endings made me start to think about my ending to it. And it slipped into a kind of place where the man was being charged by a tiger and the elephant couldn't save him because it didn't have the tusks.
Oh, yes. Yes, creative endings.
I imagine the guy coming back from the forest, because when he first went into the forest, remember, he was looking at all the trees with covetous greed as well. So I thought maybe that was going to be part of it.
Yes, well, I mean, the story's, of course, it's just an episode, isn't it? Yes. So, yes, Metta.
Which ending was the one that you first worked with?
Okay, which one do you think?
Well, we were thinking that it might have been the brimstone and fire opening up.
Yes, that's the classic ending, or that's the original ending. But I was telling them, my friends, the other night, that I used to tell this story when I was at family camp at the retreat center in Massachusetts. So I would have a group of 10-year-olds, and I'd have them sitting in front of me, and we'd be talking about the experience of wanting. Like, you know, have you ever had a piece of pie and then you really want another piece? And then you really want another piece? And that they're going, yeah, they've had that experience, or whether it was popcorn or whatever, Halloween candy. And what was the result? Oh, the tummy ache, you know, they experienced the result of, you know, their greed, and nobody saying that's enough. So I said, and what's helpful to you? Well, it's helpful if my mom would just say, you've had enough. So it seemed to me like, in this story, that there needs to be wisdom in the giving, and that the generosity is actually, it is generous to say enough's enough and take care of yourself, really, in a sense. So, but, I mean, the journey of the Bodhisattva on his way to becoming the Buddha is a journey of perfecting these qualities of generosity and kindness. And so we sometimes see in these stories extremes. And it's really, it's interesting, it's sort of like, does the end justify the means? Because his ultimate birth and his attainment as the Buddha has been a tremendous gift through the centuries to countless people. And yet sometimes in the stories you see that the decision to manifest generosity might not have been so skillful. That sometimes generosity needs to be balanced with wisdom. So I always think of these as teaching stories that we can work with, that we're working with, that we're engaging with, and we're thinking about as we hear them and as we reflect on them.
That was a Jataka
tale? That one was, yes.
And the Buddha was the elephant?
Yes.
Not
the forester, yeah. Yes?
I just wanted to mention, I was really resonating with the way the elephant, when he gave his tusk, said, may I receive insight? Because I think every time you give a gift, especially if it's difficult, it could be a material or emotional gift, it's an opportunity to learn, like, from that experience. So that really touched me, actually.
It's true, and the fact that he paused and he took the time to kind of lift his tusks aloft and to show that he wasn't just handing them off, but that they were significant, and it was a significant gift. And it's true, generosity is a way of letting go of our habits of grasping. So, yeah, thank you for that. Brock.
So on that story, just one thought I had was, and I kind of kind of figured the original was, you know, digging out the root, and then that got pretty ugly. Like, and I suppose he could have just dwelt on that whole, you know, how ugly that is. That I think that could have an impact of, you know, that's pretty ugly. But sometimes I'm greedy too, so just to reflect on that's not, you know, that's something that I don't want to be like that person who's with the never-ending greed and what that led to.
Okay.
Just kind of a, oh, that it was such an extreme. That's like, oh, I better really investigate, and I don't want to be like that guy.
That's true. That's true. That's a whole other way of seeing it. That it's a cautionary. Yeah.
But it takes the breath away to think that the bodhisattva was willing to possibly die. I thought that you were going to describe blood coming within the earth and the fire, because that's everything. You have to give everything.
Yes, well, there are other stories in which he gives his life to feed animals. Yeah. It is extreme.
So we use our own wisdom or the wisdom of the Dharma? The Dharma teaches that.
Well, I think there's always context. So, I mean, these stories are, they're centuries old and are really the lay person's, often described as the lay person's entrance into the Buddhist teachings. So, and to be, I think that's why I would be a little hesitant to tell that third ending in some contexts, because it is a bit gruesome and a bit grim. And I would want to encourage listeners to think about wise generosity. And it's the same, you know, when meditation teachers give a Dana talk and talk about supporting the teachings, they will often say, give so that you have no regrets, neither that you didn't give enough, nor that you gave too much. So it's a beautiful practice, and a one that people over the years, as they support teachers in different ways, they come to understand, oh, what is that balance of giving that feels like it is appropriate, but not too much, that, you know, I'm not, you know, depriving myself of my own well-being. So it's interesting. And yet the Buddha also said, beautiful teaching on generosity, that, you know, even if it was your last, you know, bowl of rice to share, if there was someone else to share it with, because of the benefit of sharing, the benefit to you of sharing. So it's definitely not black and white. So, well, I mentioned at the beginning, but I'll just mention again that all the proceeds beyond, there's a basket there for donations to the rent of the space for this evening, because this is a kind of add-on to the weekend. I'll be giving a retreat this weekend here, illuminating the world, befriending the mind, mindfulness, and the path of practice. But so you can make a donation for the rent, and if you wish to, you can make a donation to the World Wildlife Fund. And I'm really pleased to be able to send in a donation for the amazing work that they're doing to help create conservation areas for elephants and help with preventing poaching in parts of Africa and Asia. So thank you so much. I'm so pleased that you all came and found your way here this evening.